Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we're all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, and it will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I'm just super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Excellent, excellent. I had a good holiday, and hope you did as well.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful time here at the ranch, as we like to call it here in Highlands Ranch. Had snow on the ground for Christmas Day, and actually I've had snow in my backyard, I think I've mentioned, since October. So that, it was kind of nice to get a fresh cover, though, really. And
you would kind of like to go someplace and have a green Christmas at this point, I guess.
Well, we did Hawaii last year, so I feel like I've gotten to experience a variety of Christmases. How did it go there at the Gordon homestead? Santa brought everybody what they were looking for?
Oh, absolutely. The kids were great. It was fun. It's one of these deals. How the parents you tend to have a late night when you're the parents of small kids on Christmas Eve, and so my head hits the pillow about 1:30 or 2.
Right.
And it felt like I know it was longer than that, but it felt like 5 minutes later. The little 4-year-old comes running in. He came. It's both an exhausting and a beautiful feeling.
Much fun.
And,
sure.
And so you drag yourself
thinking,
out of bed.
This would also be fun at 7:30 or even.
Yeah, it would be just as much fun then. But you realize that they don't stay young forever, and so you drag your middle-aged rear end out of bed and go in there and have some fun with the little kids, and it was great.
Outstanding.
So it was a good one at the Gordon house.
Glad to hear it. Well, we've also got a special guest chat host with us this evening, returning. He's come home for Christmas. It's our old buddy Michael Darling. Hey, Michael.
Good evening, and Happy New Year's to both of you.
A Happy New Year to you. Thanks for sitting in for Sally. She is in the process of, I believe it was taking a trip to Arizona. Is that correct, Stephen? I think she was en route.
Yeah, she's I hope that we can get her back soon and she has a safe trip and everything. But with moving, it's hard to know how long you're going to be out of pocket. So
absolutely. Yeah. But in the meantime, Michael, great to have you back. How was your Christmas?
Everything I would have wanted it to be.
Excellent.
Well, there you go. All right. You can't ask for more than that now, can you? Well, we've got
a
terrific...
I wouldn't.
there it is. good thinking. All right. Well, you'll be running the chat host for us. We're going to check in with you periodically to see what the chatters are all about. Expect some interesting conversation going on in there this evening. This is a great show we've got tonight, Stephen. We're doing our third installment in our series on the countdown to Foresight 2010, and we have a very special guest with us. Would you like to introduce our guest?
Absolutely. We have returning to Fast Forward Radio, Jay Storrs Hall. He's a scientist, visionary, entrepreneur, and a president of the Foresight Institute, and we're very glad to have you back. His nickname is actually an acronym of Jay Storrs Hall. We're glad to have you, Josh, returning.
Hello.
Awesome having you back on the program. Josh, how's your holiday season treating you?
Well, I tell you, I wish I had my flying car. I drove down to Nashville for Christmas from central Pennsylvania, which is about 1,000 miles, and I'm actually on my way back up. We had to stop off in Winchester, Virginia. It's really a sort of a two-day drive, so I'm here in the midst of Winchester. It's actually a very nice place. I'm here installed in the George Washington Hotel.
No doubt he actually stayed there at some point, probably, or
quite possibly. It's a gorgeous old place here. A dinner at a really, really cool place called the Village Square, where they have a bar that's called V Squared.
there you go. All right.
That appeals to us, yeah.
A little bit of geek appeal there, huh?
Yeah.
That's great. Well, that's got to be a scenic drive from Pennsylvania to Nashville, although
I guess during
the holidays
it's really, really gorgeous. And there's, from here in north, there's snow, and from here in south, there's it's mostly you can actually see the ground. We were down here a few months back, and when the leaves are turning along this Skyline Drive and so forth, it's just absolutely gorgeous.
Oh, sure, that's got to be one of the nicest drives around. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But with the flying car, you could have done it in a couple hours.
With the flying car, it would have been a couple of hours instead of a couple of days. So, you gotta think.
Yeah, you got to look at those trade-offs. Well, listen, I have to add a couple of credentials to the introduction that Stephen gave you, because I submitted your bio to Blog Talk Radio. Just took copy from the description of the show that I had written, so that they would put an ad up, and they did put an ad up this week. And according to Blog Talk Radio, you are not only the president of the Foresight Institute, you're now the founder. So that's a big promotion for you.
Well, that's not right. That's not right. No.
Promoted the founder. No, we've...
By Eric Drexler and his then-wife, Chris Peterson.
Yes.
In 1986 or thereabouts, I think.
Yeah,
but
actually...
It is really one of the oldest futurist institutes out there. There are a few longer-standing ones, but not very many.
Well, it's been around for, 24 years now?
Like that.
And
right.
The Foresight Conference is celebrating its 20th anniversary coming up in January.
Right.
So that's pretty exciting. Yeah. And speaking of anniversaries, I just read on the Foresight blog that today is a very important 50th anniversary. Can you tell us about that?
This is actually the 50th anniversary to the day of the original Feynman talk, There's Plenty of Room at the Bottom, which is sometimes pointed at as the very beginning of nanotechnology. So we didn't realize it coming in, but what an auspicious day.
Yeah, you know? We couldn't have picked a better day to have the president of the Foresight Institute on the program than the 50th anniversary of Richard Feynman giving that talk. And last 2 months, I would say, Stephen, hasn't it been? We've been kind of tracing through the history of nanotechnology, and we've been talking a lot about engines of creation and how Eric and Christine formed the Foresight Institute and the influence that the Feynman talk had. So it's really kind of cool to see all this coming together as we've been counting down towards the conference coming up in Foresight 2010. Now, the other credential that I would like to add to the introduction is poet, because we were very, very impressed with your seasonal poem. And since this is in addition to part three in our series on counting down to the conference, this is also kind of our, as I like to call it, Star Wars holiday special tonight. I was wondering if you would be willing to treat us to a reading of your visit from St. Assembler.
I'll be happy to do that. Would you want me to do it now or wait till?
Do you have it with you? Or?
If you're able to do it now, let's. I say we jump right into it. Where Stephen, does that work with your plan for the program? We're kind of
absolutely
ad hoc tonight, so.
Oh yeah.
Sipping eggnog here in the virtual studio, you know.
All right. Well, you sort of need to sit back and get in the mood and imagine that you're in some classical house surrounded by snow and the stars are shining in the sky and you've just settled down for a long winter's nap, and the poem is entitled A Visit from St. Assembler. With apologies to Clement Moore, by yours truly, Jay Storzal. 'Twas the night before breakthrough, when all through the house Not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The smocks were hung up in the lab for the night, in hope that a rest would bring some new insight. The children were nestled all snug in their beds, while visions of molecules danced through their heads. Ma in her kerchief, and I in my cap, had just settled our brains for a long winter's nap, when a logical inference struck me so hard, I let down my everyday common sense guard. The mind on the crest of this new point of view took wild flights of fancy and made them seem true. My wondering eyes, as I stood agape, saw a miniature robot, complete with a tape. Of such a micronic molecular mass, I knew in a moment it must be Saint... Well, it must be a molecular assembler. more rapidly than I could figure it out, he built more of himself from stuff lying about. He built Dasher and Dancer, they, Prancer and Vixen, and then Comet and Cupid and Donner and Blitzen. Now faster than I could match each with his name, they doubled and doubled, and they all were the same, as dry leaves that before the wild hurricane fly, or rather, like smoke, they took off to the sky. And I could imagine I heard on the roof the prancing and pawing of each tiny hoof. Down the chimney they came, eating all of the soot, as carelessly diamonds were dropped on my foot. Another small cloud of atomic erectors were turning the roof into solar collectors. I looked at one closely, a jolly old speck. He had plenty of arms and a bivalent neck. His tape told him what he was programmed to do. He was fast and efficient, self-referent, too. He looked like a gang of maniacal boys had been put in a room full of wee tinker toys, and making a mechanical jest of their teacher, allowed it to mutate into an odd creature. Benzene rings on his fingers, propellers for toes, buckyball for a belly, and lithium nose. His arms moved like twinkling magical wands. His ears were connected by hydrogen bonds. A wink of his eye and a twist of his head soon gave me to know I had nothing to dread, though New Jersey, the previous hour or two, had melted to form a sweet, sticky gray goo. He said not a word, but went straight to his work. The three more just like him and turned with a jerk. It was hard to see whether he gestured or beckoned, for he did it a million or more times a second. Not a bit of the household escaped from his hustle. Even the doors received eyes, ears, and muscle. I'd just gotten used to a toaster with brains. I now must contend with intelligent drains. Then, most of them left through the skin of my hands to do a refurbishing job on my gland. But I heard them exclaim, ere they dove out of sight, "Happy future to all, and to all a good night."
All right. Wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
Putting a happy face on Grey Goo. Oh, that's great.
Well,
I
mentioned that at the time I wrote that, I was living in New Jersey, so it was highly appropriate.
Okay.
Enjoying your time there, were you?
New Jersey is somehow the butt of all jokes, whether you live there or not.
It seems to be. That is.
All roads lead to Rome. All jokes lead to New Jersey.
There it is. Well, that's just terrific. And I guess that based on what I read on the Foresight blog, this is a piece that has been around for a while. You didn't just come up with that this year.
Oh yeah, yeah. I wrote that back in the early '90s, right after. Not very long after I had founded the site at Nanotech, which is where I first posted it.
Absolutely. Well, it's a terrific kind of summary of a lot of the ideas that we talk about when we talk about nanotechnology, presented in obviously in verse and in a very familiar setting with the Night Before Christmas visit from St. Nicholas. It really kind of just lays out what we're going to be talking about this evening, and I thought it would be a fun start since we're going to be adding a little additional holiday material a little bit later in the program. But let's talk a little about your own history with nanotechnology. As we get into looking at Foresight 2010, talking about the conference, how did you come to be involved with the Foresight Institute, and why would you recommend those listening to give the organization a look and think about attending the conference?
Well, it's really two completely different stories, but I wound up having about 2 degrees of separation from Eric and Chris in the Institute. I had a friend who had I was at Rutgers at the time, and he had gone from Rutgers to work at intern at Xerox PARC, and he had a friend there who knew a bunch of people, including Ralph Merkel and Eric and so forth. And so he was back on a visit to New Jersey and was telling me, oh, all the you know folks over in Silicon Valley are really keen on this nanotechnology idea. And I said, well, what's that? And this is about, oh, I don't know, 87 or so. He said, oh, it's making things really, really small. And I said, nah, that's nothing interesting. The really important thing is going to be self-replicating robots.
Uh-huh.
And so he points me at Eric's book, and I realize, of course, that you know the self-replicating robots are in there. And so I thought, you know, this is really cool, became more interested, and ultimately, I think a year after that, founded the Sci-Nanotech discussion group on the Usenet. By the time the first conference rolled around in 89, I had sort of become one of the people whose name was associated with nanotech, at least to some small extent.
Just for the benefit of some of our younger listeners, Usenet was kind of like blogs back in the day, right? Back. You know, just to give an idea, I used to read Usenet groups all the time, and so you actually ran the one that was dedicated to nanotechnology.
That's right. Yes.
Very cool. So, take us through, if you can. You know, we've got a little bit of time here. What was Foresight all about then in the early days, and what is it about today? Can you kind of take us through the briefly through the history of the group?
Well, let's see. Foresight was founded to help people understand just what a huge difference in their conception of what the future would be like nanotechnology makes. And although it sort of wandered a bit, going through a series of different presidents and so forth, it's essentially under my leadership has come back to that original idea and picked up exactly what its original mission was, which is essentially to say, look, if you don't understand the kind of power and the kind of changes that this technology can make, you just really have no idea of what the future might be like, for good or evil. And so in order to help people understand what they're facing and therefore be able to make intelligent decisions about what needs to go on in the future, I mean, this is all, after all, a democracy, and people are out there supposed to be making this kind of decision. Foresight is there to help them have the appropriate kind of foresight. I take as Foresight's charter the same thing I took for the Sci-Nanotech charter, which is essentially all of the technologies that got talked about in Engines of Creation, lo these many years ago, possibly with the exception of the ones that have already happened, which are mostly the Internet. I mean, it's amazing to what extent Eric predicted many of the social phenomena that the Internet has brought us. He didn't quite understand how it would, you know, exactly how it would work out, but he predicted things like the hypertext nature of the web, which was there were a number of early technologies that used computer networks to make links between documents and provide the ability for many people to present different points of view on different subjects and so forth. And I think that actually comes true sort of faster than anybody realized it would. And that may well be a good thing, because the internet is a very powerful engine for inquiry and truth. It's very good that we have that before some of the crazier physical technological capabilities, or AI, for example, which is also mentioned in the book, have had their huge impact. But if you're worrying about whether all the weird crazy things that Eric talked about in that book are actually going to happen, I'll just point you at the internet and its effects, and say, you know, he did about as good a job as you could have imagined in 1986 predicting that.
And you know what's great about that example? For anyone who has read Engines of Creation, I was actually working on my master's degree back at that time, and I didn't read the book then, but this notion of hypertext was kind of coming online, and people were talking about how big it was going to be, these computer networks, and there was going to be this interconnectivity of information, and nobody had a clue what it was, right, what it would look like. But Eric actually steps us through why you need that, and why that is going to be a major driver for other advances that are going to come, and I like to look at that particular part of that book now and think, okay, as difficult a time as I had imagining the internet from this, that's how different our world is going to be once some of these other changes start to come online too.
Yeah. Although there were, in fact, some people, one of the precursors to the Sci Nanotech list was one that I was involved in, which was called the Human Nets list. And it was, in fact, a bunch of people sort of discussing how the internet was going to go. There was an awful lot of ballyhoo and smoke and so forth, and people's crazy ideas being pushed, but many of the basic parameters had been envisioned. And this was, in fact, on the ARPANET, after all, at the time.
Sure.
So the original Usenet, which was all phone connectivity, had actually folded over into the ARPANET, and it was all of the stuff was actually being carried on the direct ancestor of the internet. So there were people doing that, and they actually had a reasonably decent idea of some of the things that were going to happen, which is one of the things that I like to look back on and say that the sort of stuff that we're discussing now here and that we work on at the Foresight Institute really have something of a chance of being a nice outline, a profile of the future, as it were, of what's coming up in the next decade or two.
I've got a question from the chat room. You mentioned, in order to understand the way the future is going to go, you need to understand these ideas and what it could mean, whether for good or for evil. And the question's asked, do we get a vote? Or is there anything that people can do to influence whether these things come down in a way that's good for us or bad for us?
Oh, I think certainly. The most obvious thing is that the good things are going to be the best bulwarks against the bad things, and you can simply just sit down and get going and work on building the good things. And when you do that, you're going to make the mainstream, the responsible people that care about such things, be more powerful when the bad things crop up, as they probably will one way or the other. So I think that probably one of the worst things that can happen is that people, simply by looking at what the possible downsides are, get this sort of fear freeze and believe that they can somehow stop the world and get off, and don't try to do anything, or try in fact to make nothing happen, because that's really a very false way.
Well, I'm reminded of a bumper sticker. You could adapt it to say, you know, if you outlaw molecular assemblers, only bad guys will have molecular assemblers. So I guess
that's some sense of the way it's going to work. And basically,
yeah.
All these scare stories are predicated on a very simple incorrect equation, which is: imagine somebody with the power of molecular nanotechnology in today's world. If the somebody has evil intentions, you're in bad shape. But that's really the same as imagining a century ago somebody with a B-52 and atomic weapons flying around, you know, holding the country to ransom and blowing up cities and all this sort of stuff. And the fact is that the technology was in fact completely capable of doing that, but that would never have been a good reason for failing to build airplanes, because when the whole world had airplanes, you had a technology where the offense and the defense grew up together, and the mainstream grew the defenses. And in fact, the people who had airplanes that were being used for evil would have built them anyway. And so the fact that the good guys built airplanes was in fact the best part of our defense against such things. And I think the same thing is going to be true about nanotechnology.
Well, and let me just doff my radio talk show cap for a moment and put on my senior associate hat and suggest that if anyone's interested in having a vote, if you want to have a say in these things, go to foresight.org and check out all the resources available by means of by way of the Foresight Institute, and think about attending Foresight 2010, which is your opportunity to actually learn about and be a part of all of what we're talking about here. So let's shift gears just slightly, Josh, and tell us what we can expect to see happening at the conference coming up. We've had a couple of good weeks of discussion of that with our first week, Michael Anisimov and Ralph Merkel, and then last week we had Brian Wong and Robin Hanson on. So we've had a nice kind of sampling, little appetizer course for the conference. What's your take on what's going to be happening there, and what kinds of things people can be looking for at that event?
Well, this is going to be the first Foresight event in a while where all the speakers were specifically invited, and I planned the program myself in my head. I just said, okay, these are the people I want to hear talking about the future, and I invited them, and they're coming.
You get to do that when you're president, right?
Yeah, I do. It's great. So what's happened is that unlike some of the sort of more recent Foresight events where under previous presidents, where Foresight had sort of moved a little towards the current day lab practice of people doing molecular work and so forth, which was getting a little it's highly technical and it's not enormously informative about the shape of the future. It's just what I did was to try and move the focus back to to futurism. So we have a spread ranging from these guys, like the people who've just won the latest Simon Prize for some very significant advances in lab nanotech practice, over to the futurists, such as the SIAI guys like Michael and Nisimov, who are keenly interested in the impact that artificial intelligence is going to make in the next couple of decades, and some mainstream economists, which has not really been a focus of futurism, but really ought to be, because of all the sciences that predict the sort of things that are going to happen that affect my life and yours, economists are a very underrepresented group in this discussion, and I think that we need to hear more of them. So we're going to have a couple of mainstream, flat-out, you know, economics professors at major universities talking, as well as all the tech guys, and including Robin Hanson, who you had on the show. So this is actually going to be what I'm trying to do actually is to recreate the very broad based but integrated nature of all the talks, exactly the way they were at the very first Foresight Conference back in 1989, which is probably one of the coolest meetings I've ever been to in my life. So I'm trying to recreate that, and that's what we're looking for.
You know, when Michael was on 2 weeks ago, we were talking about the first one we attended. We both attended the Foresight Conference for the first time in 2003. And, very much that kind of transformative experience of, wow, this is very cool. This is the sort of thing I've been looking for. This is this is the kind of event that I would like to recommend that other people go to. So definitely can understand what you're talking about when you talk about trying to recreate that initial experience. Let's talk about. It's interesting you mentioned economics because that's one that we find ourselves ending up on frequently when we talk about nanotechnology and artificial intelligence, both, what are the economic factors that need to be in place in order to get us to a certain point? And then what are the wacky, crazy economic things that start to happen once we cross that chasm, once the nano or AI singularity occurs, you've got this kind of economic singularity taking place as well. So the interdisciplinary approach, I think, is very interesting, and that's core to what you're doing with Foresight 2010, because you're talking about both nanotechnology and artificial intelligence. So tell us why those two topics are correlated and why they both get top billing for the conference.
Well, I think basically that those are the two technologies that are likely to make a really huge difference. They're going to be transformative. They're going to be revolutionary as opposed to merely evolutionary. Over the next couple of decades, and they're probably going to be the ones that form the basis of what some people are calling the singularity. I don't usually use the term singularity, mostly because it sort of implies that you can't see through it, you can't see what's going to happen, and so forth. And that just doesn't sound right for an organization that calls itself Foresight.
yeah, good point.
But the basic idea is the same. The basic idea is that there's going to be this revolutionary development, and I spent a lot more time studying history and the history of industrial revolutions, and in fact the industrial revolution, but the previous ones as well. You know, the inventions of everything from the wheel and the fire and agriculture and so forth, and the other accoutrements of civilization. And I think that we can learn some things from those developments and how humanity changed across them. And in fact, every single one of them was beneficial. We're all better off because we have wheels and fire and agriculture and the printing press and steam engines and so forth. And I think the same thing is going to be the case across this coming one. In fact, I think that we're halfway through this one, that most of the revolutions have had an interesting double structure, where you had an informational revolution followed by a physical revolution, and that the classic one, of course, being the invention of the printing press, and then science, and then what we call technology in the Industrial Revolution, and that the revolution that we're in the middle of is exactly an echo of that, where the printing press corresponds to the Internet, which is an enormously faster way of getting more people more information faster. And it involves a step up in a kind of literacy for everybody, but along with that comes a huge amount more informational power and ability. And then on the heels of that came science, and as you can see what's going on now, that science is sort of transforming itself to use the Internet and to use computers, and I think ultimately that the full echo of science is going to be artificial intelligence. And then the echo of the Industrial Revolution with its physical transformation of what we can do, extending the bits to atoms, if you will, is going to be nanotech.
Wow.
That's deep.
Yeah, imagine the world transformed by the Industrial Revolution. Now we have it on, you know, even on steroids is such a cliche, and falls so short of what we're the level of change we're talking about. And I think if you, it goes back to your to the first part of the analogy, which is compare the Internet with the printing press, right? If as the Internet is to the printing press, so AI is to science at that time, and so nanotechnology will be to the Industrial Revolution. That's amazing.
You know, I read an article in Wired magazine today about how really the human mind is really poorly designed or poorly wired for science, of all things, and the idea basically is that we look out upon the world and we look for things to build up our preconceived notions, and we tend to discard things that don't build that that sense of reality we have, and so that may, you know, if something comes along that, you know, just doesn't jibe with what we already believe, then we tend to discard it. And I'm wondering if at some point AI wouldn't just be a natural for helping us out in that way. Looking at those things that we tend to discard, and being, you know, in a sense, being a better scientist than ourselves.
Well, I think that's right in one sense. I think that an AI is going to be more comfortable doing science because we can build it that way. But
yeah.
I think that a lot of these people who look at the brain and say, oh, it's no good for this or it's no good for that and so forth, have basically forgotten the key element of the human brain is that it is in fact programmable, that we are able to take ideas that we've invented and use them to think better. And one of those really, really key ideas is, in fact, science. So that somebody understands the idea of science and likes science and decides that that's what they want to do, can do it. And we should never lose track of the fact that the fact that we can even sit down and say our brains are no good for science means that we've gotten an amazing understanding of not only of science but of our brains. Something that that no other animal has come even close to, and it's sort of fashionable right now because people are discovering more and more stuff about the brains and looking at the sort of way that they might build one better and so forth. This is like any other machine. We begin to understand how it works, and we are able to say, look, wow, I can improve this. And so, yeah, we'll be able to build improved and faster brains and all this sort of stuff. But never lose track of the fact that we actually have brains that we can improve simply by learning things. We can learn what science is and learn how to do it. And bingo, we have brains that can do science where our brains previously couldn't do science. And that's the key watershed.
Right.
The key watershed is not doing science a little better. The key watershed is going from not being able to do science to being able to do science.
Yeah, I see what you mean. You know, and you know, if we fall short of our aspirations in science, then it's no different than anything else that we do. We don't have to be perfect to make advancements, I guess, is my point. Yeah, so I understand where you're coming from.
Well, the interesting thing here to add to that is, I guess, going from not being able to do science to being able to do science, and then with the advent of true artificial intelligence, being able to do science, 10,000 times faster, a million times faster, right? That's a big leap.
Yeah, well actually, one of the things that I like to, you know, sort of preach about and so forth, simply the fact that science is one of the most wonderful things that human beings can do. And we're in one of the most amazing, wonderful, exciting periods of science that ever existed. I mean, people look at the second half of the 20th century and they say, oh, look how progress has slowed down. You know, my great-grandfather didn't have electric lights and indoor plumbing and cars and so forth. And, you know, by the mid-20th century, they had all those wonderful things. And now we live still roughly the same way Leave It to Beaver lived. And in fact, that's true. You know, we've sort of managed to satisfy most of our physical wants and so forth. And the rate of progress that reached down to the consumer level outside of iPhones and computers and so forth has seemed to slow down a bit. But science itself has tackled some of the greatest issues that the human mind has ever attempted to solve, like what's the nature of life? And during the second half of the 20th century, we cracked that. I mean, that's amazing. That was in 1950, nobody understood how life worked. And by the year 2000, we not only had a solid understanding of how the molecular machines that make cells work actually worked, and you know what DNA was, what it was for, how it worked, what proteins did, the whole cycle of self-reproduction and information storage in DNA and so forth. In 1950, DNA was a chemical. In year 2000, it was a tape full of bits, and that's just a radical re-understanding of the world, and that scientific revolution is still going on. I mean, that's sort of the first step. The next step is understanding how the mind works, and we're right on the verge of that. We're beginning to be able to take those lessons from biology that got learned in the latter half of the 20th century and make them into physical nanotechnology. But we're beginning to unravel the way our actual minds work. And that's probably the greatest scientific adventure of all. And so, you know, if you don't understand science, you're just missing the show here. This is really the exciting thing that every human life has ever led up to, at least in my point of view.
Now let's talk about understanding the mind. Is that understanding the big breakthrough in artificial intelligence that folks like the Singularity Institute are looking for? Are we talking about the same thing here, or are you referring to something different?
Well, they're talking about a breakthrough in terms of building an intelligence, and
right.
I think that's going to happen sort of kind of at the same time and kind of because of the increasing understandings of how the human brain works. I mean, there's a lot of things. One of my very favorite examples is learning how to build airplanes by watching birds. And the fact is, that a bird and an airplane don't really work exactly the same, but they use the same general principles. And the more you know about a bird, the better you know how to build an airplane. And the same thing is going to be true of artificial intelligence. And so we're getting the tools right now to be able to build brains, to investigate the way the actual human brain works, to map out its circuit diagram, to watch it in operation with fMRIs and so forth. And these are just getting better and better every year. And so the detail with which we can understand what's actually going on in there is improving and improving. And the insights that that gives us into the kind of things that we have to build are also improving. That doesn't mean that we have to build, you know, all the feathers on the bird's wing in order to be able to build an airplane. It does mean that we have to understand, you know, why the bird's wing has the shape it does, and it does mean that we need to understand why it flaps, either whether or not we're going to make our airplane wings to flap or not.
Right.
By the way, do you know why a bird flaps its wings?
I do not know why a bird flaps its wings. Why are birds not like fixed wing instead of flapping?
Well, because nature has a hard time with propellers, I think. But anyway.
Well, it's actually a very cool way of combining the lift and the propulsion. Basically, what a bird does is glide like a glider, and the glider glides down at a certain angle because it you know, a fixed wing glider. Let's just imagine that it had a lift to drag ratio of 10. Okay, so it can glide down at a 10% grade. Okay, what the bird does when it flies is that its wings move down at a 10% grade, just like the glider would. Okay, and then it just picks them up again and glides down another step.
Oh, wow!
And so that's how. It's gliding down the whole time, but it's doing it by pushing its wings down with respect to its body, and it sort of jerks them back up again and glides down another set. So the flapping part is actually the propulsion, and the shape of the wings would provide plenty of lift even if the bird were not flapping, if only it could continue moving level with the same speed, and so understanding that says, okay, if we want to make an airplane that doesn't flap its wings, all we have to do is give it a propulsion, and bingo, we're all set. And the same kind of things are going to come out of our study of brains.
Yeah, we might not build a machine that's biological like the human mind, but from what we learn from the human mind, we'll give us some ideas on how to get there, huh? Okay.
Well, I think actually one of the cool things is that we'll be able to actually build a machine that works the way we think we do, and see if it really works.
See if it actually
can. We'll learn a lot about ourselves, as well as having useful machines. And so one of the things that's going to come out of the AI era is just a deeper understanding of what we really are and how we work and so forth, as well as having all these cool machines to do all our thinking for us, and do all our other work for us too, by the way.
Well, looking forward to that, especially I was very excited to get a snowblower for Christmas. Now all I need is for the thing to turn itself on, go out there and take care of blowing the snow, then drive to the office and do my job for me, and I think we'll be in pretty good shape. Which comes first, Josh? Artificial intelligence, true artificial intelligence, or true nanotechnology? We tried to get a fight going between Ralph Merkel and Michael Anisimov on this subject 2 weeks ago, but we failed. So you get the definitive answer to the question as president of the Foresight Institute.
Well, in my best guess, which could obviously be very wrong, we get what is going to be in retrospect called true AI in around 1920 and true nanotech in around 1930. Not 1920.
20,
yeah. I'm still living in the previous century. I'm a child of the Eisenhower administration, so, you know. I think that we're about 10 years from true AI in about 20 years from true nanotech. Now, the fact is that we're going to see a lot of stuff that's A, labeled AI and nanotech in the interim, and B, is actually going to represent significant advances toward that and have increasing capabilities. And so, while it's all going on and all the hype is coming out and so forth, it's actually going to be kind of hard to pick. But I think the thing I would call the watershed is when the technology becomes autogenous. That is to say that when your AI is actually capable of writing new AIs, or when your nanotech is capable of building new nanotech. Okay, right now we have AI programs that do all these cool things, you know, driving cars and whatnot. And we have nanotech that is capable of creating these amazing composites and molecular circuitry and all this sort of stuff. But the point where it really becomes of age and becomes revolutionary rather than evolutionary, and the price of it begins to drop as opposed to getting more expensive for the new capabilities, is going to be where it itself, either the AI or the nanotech, becomes significantly instrumental in creating more of the same. And that's what I call the point of autogeny. And I think that is going to be, somewhere in the neighborhood of 2024 AI, and somewhere in the neighborhood of 2030 for nanotech.
You know what, Stephen, I like about this is he gave us not only an order in which they'll happen, but he gave us some dates.
That's right. I've got it on my calendar now. That's
okay. we can plan finally. So, Michael, any questions from the chat room for Josh?
When do I get my flying car?
Well, it depends on how much you're willing to spend, really. That's why economics is so interesting. If you want a flying car right now, there are people that will just dash out and build it for you. If you're willing to spend $1 million, you could have a V2L flying car now. If you're willing to spend, $100,000 or $2,000, you can get an STOL version of something that you can fly and also drive on the road pretty much right now. And it's not just one. It's not just the Terrafugia, but there are a number of these things out there. Or if you're really, really, really keen on it, you can go and build your own. I mean, the people have done that as well. But you have to sort of give your life over to it. You can't just pop out and buy one. And that's what makes the big difference. It's the point where you can pop out and buy one, and not only the point you can do that, but where anybody can do that, and the thing has enough smarts built into it that it's able to fly itself. I think really for the sort of flying cars I want, you have to wait for both of those revolutions. A decent flying car, at least the way I envision it, not only has to be able to fly itself without my having to be a pilot, but actually be really, really good at it so that I'm happy to put myself in its hands. And so that waits for the AI. But it needs to be extremely powerful to be safe. I mean, you need, for something the size of a car to fly in any kind of weather, you need at least 1,000 horsepower in that. And you need reconfigurable wings and a whole bunch of stuff that current technology isn't really quite up for yet.
What people are really looking for in a flying car is they want a vehicle that will require no additional skills over what they already have in terms of being able to drive a car. I think that's the
or
key.
Less.
What are called flying cars today are really airplanes, right? I mean, you would have to be able to fly an airplane to fly one of these so-called flying cars today. And I think they are to the true flying cars what the video projection systems of the 70s are to, like, real HD TV, okay? The right, the real flying cars are going to be, something that require, as you're saying here, real nanotech, real artificial intelligence, because basically you want to feel like you're flying it, but actually there's going to be something smarter than you in there keeping you safe, right?
Yeah, I mean, basically you want something that compares to the kind of transportation we have today, the way our cars today compare to driving a four-horse wagon. I mean, that took a lot of skill and was fairly dangerous and still didn't go fast, but it was an awful lot better than the alternative, which was lugging the stuff yourself. So it was an advance. But moving from that to the car was a major advance. And I think that the flying car, in the sense of that kind of major advance, is still in our future, unfortunately, by a couple of decades.
I've got a question from the chat room. We don't have a lot of time. Maybe in 1 minute, how is AI and nanotech going to lead to life extension in the foreseeable future?
Well, it's pretty clear in the case of nanotech, because that gives you the tools to operate on living things at the level where their machinery is, and basically that gives you the fingers that are the same size as the gears, if you'll allow me that analogy. AI is not so completely clear, but it's going to allow you to cope with the enormous complexity of systems like the human body, which are really just so complex. We have an incredibly difficult time understanding what the effects of any intervention right now is going to be. And, I mean, because all of our bodies are different, we're rapidly getting to the point where something I did to you that would make you better, if you did it to me, would make me worse. And the closer we get to being able to do the kind of powerful things that will actually make a difference in our terms of life, the more we need to be able to have a complete medical profession aimed at the individual rather than at the human race as a whole. So I think, for example, that it's very close to the point where you can go and get your own genome sequenced. I would say by the end of the decade, that's going to be possible. But then you're going to need the equivalent of the entire genetics profession working on your own personal genome to understand what's going to actually work for you. And I think that's where AI is going to have to come in.
And when you think about it, that's even a better use for artificial intelligence than keeping the flying cars up. So, listen, folks, if you want to hear more about flying cars, artificial intelligence, nanotechnology, future economics, a world transformed, you'll want to get yourself to Foresight 2010, January 16th through the 17th in Palo Alto, California. Go to foresight.org. All the details are there. And think about signing up, becoming a senior associate with the Foresight Institute. I'm one, and I recommend it to everyone who's interested in the topics that we talk about on Fast Forward Radio. Well, we're just about out of time. Josh, always a pleasure having you on the program. We wish you the very best for the new year and for Foresight 2010.
Thank you very much. Happy future to all, and to all, a good night.
Well said. All right, Stephen, we're going to have to postpone our Tales of the Paranormal till next week, but PJ Manny will be very pleased that we've saved that for her. Tell us about our music this evening.
Well, this has become a holiday tradition. This will be the third year we've re-gifted this song to our audience. This is the Re-Gifting for the Holidays song. And if you haven't ever re-gifted for the holidays, well, you're probably just not being truthful. We all have. So
this is our re-gift to all of you. All right, thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Thanks, Michael, for being with us this evening, and everyone in the chat room, everyone listening. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We look forward to being with you again next week with our special guest, PJ Manny. Until then, live to see it.